It's Richard Mackey and the UBC Law History Project. The date is the 21st of February 2013, and I'm here with Frank Carbandi at the on the fourth floor of the Allard Hall. Frank, welcome to the project. We've been starting our interviews usually with some with your background, family, and your childhood. Where are you from?
I was born on a farm in a small place in Saskatchewan called Neatpath. Had a rural school, as we all had, and the rural school that I attended taught grades 1 to 8. There was only one teacher. After you completed your grade 8, you had to move to the town school that had 2 rooms.
Yeah.
And you could take grade 9, 10, 11, 12, and 12, of course, in Saskatchewan, is senior matriculation. And all the examinations, of course, were, in those days, were written. They were all marked by teachers during a summer session in Regina.
Yes.
And I never had any problem with any of the schools that I went to in Saskatchewan. The only problem was they were always short of teaching languages. And I had 1 year of French, but I knew that to gain entrance to any university, you required 4 years of French or 4 years of foreign language.
Mm-hmm.
So after I graduated grade 12, at senior matric, I went to the University of Saskatchewan for a 6-week French course. And it supposedly brought me up to university level. And that was duly sent off to UBC along with my application.
Yes.
And UBC accepted my application. And I, in September, proceeded to Vancouver. And
so this was 1947, is that right?
I think so. Enrolled in arts and 5 subjects, including French 2. Well, after a bit of trouble with French 2, the professor had suggested maybe I should do French 1, and which I did. And at the conclusion of the year, wrote an exam and passed it. And the next year, of course, I had to take an extra year to get the second year qualification. So I had to do another year in arts. And so finished that year, but consequently, I'm one subject short for a bachelor's degree in arts.
Yeah.
However, the law school didn't see that was any problem and accepted me. And I duly proceeded to the law school. And that's,
What about your family? Were you from a farm?
Well, I was never really much of a farmer. There were 5 kids in the family, and some, you know, everybody had to work just like they had to in any farm in those days.
Mm-hmm.
They had to pull the load. And my parents were keen on education.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted their kids to get as much education as they possibly could. My father was a reeve of a municipality, and he enjoyed that sort of work. And he did all the time that I was at home. He was away a lot and doing what reeves have to do in mm-hmm. rural municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
I would say I was loosely connected with the farm. I was mm-hmm. never really a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, I did book reading more than farming.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed academics material. And
Where were you in the family? Were you?
I was the eldest, which is a choice position, I think, in most families.
Yes.
Yeah. And consequently, if there was a bit of, you know, if there was money to be spent, particularly education-wise, I had, you know, I got what I wanted. And this was a problem, of course, throughout university. You're always short of money. Students are proverbially short of money, particularly in those days. Things are different than they are today. And I know the person I roomed with here in Vancouver had a job. He had to work because he had a veteran's allowance of $60 a month, and it just wasn't enough. So he had to work at the post office. And that made it very, very difficult to do your academic work as well as your other work. I never had a second job, but I was always short of money.
Yeah.
At university, I was continually short of money. And but I always had enough to buy all the books I required, and there was no problem in that regard. It was the little extras that make life more pleasant.
Yes.
That rarely any money for.
The luxuries. Yeah.
The luxuries of life, right.
And you must have been in the, you're old enough to have lived through the Depression and the war.
Well, yes, of course, and they were terrible, the weather was really terrible in Saskatchewan in those days. And there were sandstorms, you know, that was just absolutely terrible. And that continued until about until the end of the war, practically. And then the climate suddenly changed. It started to rain. Farmers got very good crops. And the whole scene changed. Things got greener, and life became a lot more pleasant. During that, those dirty 30s, they were called, it was, I can tell you, pure hell. And a lot of people left. They moved to British Columbia, and a lot of the farmers just gave up. And that lasted for, well, during the whole basic 30s, during the beginning of the war and during the war. But it suddenly cleared up, and again, life became much more pleasant for those people that stayed back there.
And did you follow the war on the radio and like other people?
Yes, and of course I was getting old enough. I applied for service in the Merchant Marine because I was under age, and I never did get to they told me where I was going to go, but they never called me. And that, needless to say, it was a great worry for my parents that I would get a call, because they had the Murmansk Run, and that's what they were looking for. You know, and that was, a lot of people didn't make it. It was, you know, a very serious operation during the war.
That was a supply.
Supply to the Russians. Yeah. And it was a route that ran the gauntlet of German submarines and every other device the Germans could throw at vessels in the convoys.
But you managed to, you...
I just never got a call.
Never got a call.
Yeah. I think I still have the letter that I got saying, you know, we know where you are, so...
Yeah. So at the end of the war, I should mention on this recording that I looked up the biography of you in Arthur MacDonald's book, Canada's Military Lawyers, and they say in there that you were in the militia.
Oh, yes, in high school.
In high school.
Cadets to begin with, and moved from cadets to a reserve. Every little town had a reserve element, and the high school that I last attended was in a place called Herbert, Saskatchewan, and it had a reserve element there, an armored reconnaissance car unit. In those days, those units were all affiliated with a unit serving in Europe or wherever they were needed. And actually, I stayed in that outfit for quite a while. In fact, I was only released after I came out to Vancouver.
What was that outfit?
It was the eighth reconnaissance. We used to call it Eighth Recce, and it was the eighth reconnaissance regiment. And it was primarily armored cars and that sort of stuff. And we had you'd go out for little exercises on Saturdays and that sort of things that the reserve army did in those days.
And why did you why Vancouver? Why UBC?
I just wanted to get out of Saskatchewan, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
And friends of mine, good friend of mine in high school, was going to come to UBC. And he eventually went to Edmonton to take dentistry. So, of course, I had come to UBC. And no, I really wanted to come to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time, Saskatchewan required Latin. If you wanted to go to law school, you had to have Latin. Hmm. I think that was another barrier.
That's quite a requirement.
Yeah.
Even for them, I would think.
Yeah. I'm almost certain that the requirement at the University of Saskatchewan Law School was Latin. Because there were a lot of schools that taught Latin in Saskatchewan. Mm-hmm. The only trouble was, most of the teachers were only qualified to teach maybe grades 1 and 2, mm-hmm. or grades 9 and 10 of Latin. Mm-hmm. And then to get higher up, you'd have to go to a different school, probably in Swift Current or Regina or Saskatoon, one of the larger places.
So there was a bias against the... in favor of people who were in the larger urban schools.
Yeah. Well, yes. And, of course, I think they also waived it for veterans. Mm-hmm. I think they waived the requirement for veterans because the veterans started coming back. And I have a vague recollection that it was waived for veterans. But Latin, again, was more common in those days. Mm-hmm. You know, there were more people who took Latin at school.
Was it actually handy in law? Was it still used?
I really couldn't say. I don't think so. There are expressions, but there are dictionaries, you know, and that's always been the case. Most lawyers, I think even the ones that took Latin in school, must have forgotten it. Mm-hmm. And you still look it up in the dictionary.
I know in one interview, someone used the term pro bono.
Oh, yeah.
So I repeated it in the next interview, thinking I was being really clever. And the second person said, "That's an American term. We didn't use that in Canada, in Canadian law." So that I should have learned a long time ago not to dabble in languages I don't understand.
I can tell you, during the 3 years I went to law school here, there wasn't much Latin spoken.
No. Well, that's... That's good to know.
Yeah. No, I don't think... No. I think it's probably associated with law schools that occurred a long, long time ago. And then again, in British Columbia, where the law school only came into being, what, 1945? Mm-hmm. People just articled with lawyers and became lawyers. And where would you learn Latin in a law office? Mm-hmm. You know, unless you... were very studious and did it on your own. Mm. Or I guess in university we're still teaching Latin at, you know, at, in some department.
Yeah. Well, it was still just alive in the 1970s when I was an undergraduate, but almost gone.
Yeah.
So what did you, what were your undergrad, what courses did you, what did you major in as an undergraduate? What were you in the arts?
Yeah, I didn't have to major in anything. No. I just took five courses. I've really forgotten what I took. I took a legal history course. I must confess that I've forgotten. It was English 200 was the basic. You had to take it. You had to take a language course, and that was French. So that's two. I just took history course, but because you had to write an essay, two essays each term. But I must confess that I didn't really think much about my arts days, and
so you're able to get into law school without the. Without the full bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
I think we've interviewed people who in the 1960s could still do that. And people who were in the RCMP and
Well, I guess the university said 2 years at university, short, they must have looked at it. Nobody ever challenged me or even mentioned it. Mm. You know, I just, my third year at UBC, I just went to the law school, and that was it. And
where did you live when you were a student?
The first year here at UBC, I lived on a place down in 12th, West 12th, boarded. I didn't board, I had a room, and ate wherever I could. That was a big problem. Then I ran into a chap who, as I mentioned, had to work, and he had an apartment, and it was big enough. It had two or three rooms, so I just moved in there, and that was on Belmont Avenue, and that's where I lived for the rest of the university years. And of course it was handy, just walk up Sassamat Hill to the bus, catch the bus and come to UBC. And it was always it was a question of food. You have to eat. I ate at Fort Camp here, and for evening I'd go to a restaurant or something like that. It was probably deficient in a lot of good things that one was required to eat.
But in the room, you didn't have cooking facilities?
There was a stove, and there was cooking facilities, but I was never very good at cooking.
You weren't very good. I think I know what that's like. Yeah.
My friend that had rented the place, and of course, he could cook, but he didn't either because he worked in the post office. He'd finish his day at UBC, come back and go down to the post office in downtown Vancouver and put his 3 hours or whatever he worked there.
But you never did you work in the summers? Did you go off logging, for example?
The first time I think I just went home, and then I enrolled in the Canadian Officers Training Corps because I had sort of made up my mind that I really wanted to go into military, and because I had that military connection with reserves and that sort of thing, and I thought I would do that. And so that the summers for those 2 years, first and second year of law school, were spent at Camp Borden in Ontario. And again, I was in the Armored Corps, tanks, and again, that was this Armored Corps school at Camp Borden that I spent my summers. And it normally went right after we're finished at university, shipped off down to Borden, and then we finished down there just the first week in September. And made our way back to Vancouver.
They would pay your they would transport you.
Oh, everything. Yeah. Yeah.
Why law school? Had you been exposed? Did you have a family friend or?
It was just something that I wanted to do. Mm. And I really, I can't express any positive word that would indicate why I felt that way. It was, I didn't really feel that my mathematics really weren't good enough for engineering. There were always, high school 90%, that sort of thing, but I didn't feel comfortable, particularly with the advanced mathematics, analytical geometry, and that sort of stuff. It just, so that meant that was out. And medicine, no, in those days it was impossible to get into any medical school.
Yeah.
Unless you had influence somewhere. And so, what was left? And I knew lawyers, and that sounds like a reasonable
yes.
thing to try. And then, of course, with the military business, of course, during the Korean War, the Korean War was on during that period, and the Armored Corps, which I was a member, and I qualified as a lieutenant, trained lieutenant Armored Corps officer. And immediately when I graduated from law school, incidentally, the final year of law school, I was subsidized by the government. They had a program that if you wanted to enroll in the Army or the Air Force or the Navy, they would pay you second lieutenant's pay during the final year. And then, provided, of course, if you graduate. If you didn't graduate, you have to pay it back. So you had, there was a catch. You had to, or you had to serve in a more subservient position. So for the third year at law school, money was really no problem because it was only $120 or something a month, but that was, that in those days it was a lot. But when I graduated, of course, I immediately got a message to Calgary, to the regiment. Lord Strathcona's horse, Royal Canadians, that's where you're going to be.
And well, they're an old Boer War.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Regiment.
Armored regiment, yes. And they had a squadron in Korea. So that's where I went and served with them until, I guess, about a year and a half, or maybe two. And finally, I don't know, I really didn't. There was sort of it looked like a dead end business. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get my articles. I had, because they just moved me quickly. There was no chance, no articles. You graduate from law school, that's all we wanted. You're finished. But I knew that if you want to be a lawyer, and you really had to have the articles, mm-hmm. you had to have the qualification of being an article member, or completed articles with some provincial bar society. So then I started, I guess, working on the commanding officers. Why don't you post me to Vancouver? Give me a chance to article out there, because what people were doing were articling and doing other jobs at the same time. Mm-hmm. The Law Society was sort of free and easy at one time about that sort of business. Mm-hmm. And then when I came in, they had really clamped down. Mm-hmm. They said articles full time, nothing else. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, in Vancouver, I was here working here as a lieutenant doing my job. And I was given a job of processing people going back and forth from Korea. And it was called the Transit Depot at number 11 Personnel Depot down in Jericho. And so I was there, I guess, about a year and a half. And finally somebody said, okay, we'll give the guy a leave of absence, unpaid, if he wants to article. So I applied, and it was eventually granted for a year. But because my articles, I started, in those days, articles started on the quarterly. If you started in between a quarter, then you'd have to tack on 2 months or whatever it was to make up the full quarter. So in addition to my year, I had to request an additional 2 months or 3 months to get my articles. And then getting a position in between times is difficult. And eventually got a place out with Heen, Wiley, and Hyde out in Burnaby.
Mm-hmm. That's, I wrote it down, Heen, White, and Hyde.
Heen, Wiley, and Hyde.
Right.
Wiley, Wiley was a graduate in my law school, in the same term. Heen, Wiley, and Hyde, yeah.
And where were they?
In Burnaby.
In Burnaby.
And again, their business was primarily real estate, so I got to know the real estate offices in Vancouver and Westminster very well.
Mm-hmm. But do you kind of title searches and?
Oh yeah, a lot of title searches, yeah. And I guess I was involved in a couple other matters to get some practice. But a lot of the learning that went into the business I had to do on my own, because the office just didn't. It wasn't an all matters sort of office. They concentrated on real estate, and I think we had one or two criminal cases, mm-hmm. and that again was not a big feature of that particular law firm. Mm-hmm. And of course, in those days, Burnaby was being developed, and that the little law firms that started out there were primarily doing real estate. But eventually, the year was over, and I did my presence by the benchers, mm-hmm. Grilling, and I guess they must have recommended me, because I was duly called to the bar, given my certificates.
Could we go back before we get too far ahead to law school from a moment? You made a list of the professors you had, and there's not many of them. It only looks like there's five or six. Who were? What do you remember about them? Were there?
Well, I remember Malcolm McIntyre. Mm-hmm. He was everybody's favorite. Mm-hmm. He taught torts, and we really liked him. He had a way of teaching that was easy. He wasn't dynamic. He was sort of, he had an easygoing way about him. And torts was difficult. He could pose some difficult questions and listen to how you went about solving the problem. And I think he probably enjoyed some of the results that he got. So we really enjoyed Malcolm McIntyre. The other chap that I remember very distinctly was Mr. Kennedy, Dr. Kennedy. Gilbert Kennedy.
Gilbert, yeah.
Yeah. And he was a very straight-faced person that taught difficult subjects like wills and trusts, that nobody liked very much. And we found him a little difficult. Who was Ray Herbert, who just graduated a couple of years before. I remember him. He was a nice chap. Dr. Bellum. I don't remember him. Westlake, hardly remember him at all. Dr. Bourne, remember him.
He just died.
I know. Yeah. And it was really, during my whole course at law school, I never spoke to a professor. Mm. Never had an interview, nothing. Mm. Mind you, there were about 113 of us in the room, in each class, so that was not unusual. But I met him at these reunions, mm-hmm. These class reunions, and Dr. Bourne was always there with Dean Curtis. Mm. And that's where I met both of them and had chats, because they were interested in knowing what did you do after you graduated from law school and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember that Bourne had an odd way of speaking, of pronunciating certain words. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you which courses he taught. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to look at that, but I still can't remember. Labor law, that was really a dull thing, and I that must have been one of Dr. Westlake's courses.
Was Carruthers, Fred Carruthers there then? I know he was,
he's around, the name is familiar, but he wasn't on the list. I remember Carruthers, but I don't remember when or how I remember him. I don't remember having any courses from him.
But it was a small group of teachers, and they must have worked quite hard if there were 100, over 100 in every year.
Well, see, and also the dean, Dean Curtis was away, I think about 90% of the time. He worked a lot on government, federal government commissions or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we had one course from Dean Curtis, and I've forgotten now which course it was. We had a lot of people come up from downtown too. Mm-hmm. Criminal procedures and that sort of stuff were taught by lawyers from downtown. Mm-hmm.
So they must have had a practical element to them if they were taught by practicing lawyers.
Yeah, well, that was the sort of nuts and bolts courses that the people that dealt with it every day were teaching at law school. And there weren't very many. There, the criminal, I think of criminal procedure. And I can't really remember anything else that was taught by someone downtown. The Crown Prosecutor would come in and give us a lecture. But the professors, I don't think, I guess they weren't really familiar with, the nuts and bolts of what went on down in police court and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what these people were familiar with.
I've talked to one man on the phone, Blair Bailey, who's 92, and he described himself as the class of 1947, which is actually before he. And so they, in those days, before the law school, they apprenticed. Is that the word?
That's right.
And it was all lawyers from downtown.
Yeah.
And only gradually did they get a faculty here, a full-time faculty. But it sounds like you still had some people from the old system coming in from... Did the downtown people, did they come here to teach, or did you have to go down?
They came up here, yeah. Well, the first boss I had when I was taken into the judge advocate's office was a graduate of 1947 UBC Law School. Who never talked much about it, but he graduated in 1947. He was a school teacher that went to law school. And
do you remember his name?
Tony Cobus.
Cobus.
C-O-B-U-S. Anthony. And I think he came from, I've forgotten, Trail or somewhere in that area.
I'll ask Blair about him. So did you, what about the other students? Did you have a lot of friends?
What we did, there were four of us banded together.
Yeah.
And we would meet after, in the afternoon, because the law classes were all in the morning. We would meet in the afternoon and discuss points that different matters that were discussed by professors in the morning. And because there were cases, and we would talk about what did you think about, you know, how did you interpret such and such a matter? Hmm. And we did that. There were four of us, and that we stuck together during the 3 years of law school. And one chap had a problem with SUPs, but he was always, you know, he was always successful in passing the SUPs during the summer session. And so, but we, that was a survival. Mm-hmm. Because I, quite honestly, I found law school very difficult. It was the workload. The difficulty wasn't academically, it was the workload. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was in the number of courses where you can see, you know, 8 and 9 courses. And truly, those, one was a half course. I think criminal law was a half course. But then again, there was a final exam at Christmas or whatever. So, you know, that was a door too. But that was the my main problem during law school was the amount of work that law school required.
You've written down here the courses that you had over those years, and it does look pretty pretty overwhelming.
Yeah.
So it's the sheer quantity of having of remembering and learning all that information.
And case names. Mm-hmm. Because in law school it was case names, you know. And those things, it was easier when you're 20 years old, mind you, man, now to remember things like that. But it was still a problem. Mm. And there were so many. And the case books, in the law school, excuse me, they were just mimeographed very often. We had big, thick mimeographed books of cases. And sure, the professors would discuss the cases in the morning and raise the points that they felt were important in each case, or several cases for that matter. Like Donahue and Stevenson, that was a... Every law student in the world, I think, has heard of Donahue and Stevenson. Yeah. And that was one of the cases that I remember. But again...
What was that one about?
Yeah.
Or do you remember?
You have to give me a moment to hold.
Well, you remembered the name anyway.
Donahue Stevenson.
Can look it up.
I think it was something in a bottle. It's an English case, and I think there was a dead insect, in one of those English drink bottles, and I think the drink bottle was couldn't see. It was a special kind of drink that the English like. And anyway, that's
lime cordial or something?
No, it was like a pop drink, actually, but it was...
Shandy or... Anyway.
Anyway, that was Don Ewan Stevenson. It was the bug in the bottle. And it went on. I think it probably went... I forgot, did it go House of Lords or not? I'm not sure now. But again, there were each thing had a famous case. Each contract would have certain cases that were more outstanding, test cases really, on which the law, subsequent law, was based. And but the work, you'd see, people would come in at the beginning of the year and then disappear. Mm-hmm. The workload just overwhelmed them. Mm-hmm. And it was a slog. Quite honestly, law school was a slog.
So there was a attrition with people leaving.
Yeah.
You said 113.
Well, I never did count them, but there were, and you can't go by the list there because they did. The list doesn't include the people who had subs. Mm-hmm. And but I think we started with 115, if I remember. I don't think anyone did a nose count. Mm-hmm. And but those H huts were pretty full, and there were big huts.
Who were the other three friends who were in your group?
Well, Bill Quinn. They're all dead now, incidentally. They've mm-hmm. all died.
Oh dear. Yeah.
Bill Quinn. He was a Saskatchewan type. Roland Barnes. He graduated same year. Al McDonnell became a judge. He was a Supreme Court judge in BC, and he died several years ago.
Where were and Barnes? Where was he from?
Right here, Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. McDonnell, was he local?
He was from Vernon. I think it was Vernon. And then he went up to Prince Rupert or somewhere to practice, and then he became a judge.
How did you select each other? Just random friends. Yeah.
Well, Barnes actually went into the legal branch too, and Bill Quinn, of course, went back to Alberta and practiced law there. And Al went. He went up north to Prince Rupert. I think Prince Rupert, and until he was called to the Supreme Court.
Did you know Bill Quinn in Saskatchewan?
No. No, we all met here in Vancouver. And it was, I guess, where we were sitting. We normally sit in the same spot, mm-hmm. and that's probably the way the group started. And
did other law students also have their groups?
I couldn't say. I really don't know.
It sounds like a good idea to meet immediately after the classes when the material is still fresh.
Yeah, it worked wonderfully well for us. Mm-hmm. I couldn't, you know. We worked in after we had our little session. Of course, some of us would stay in the library and work. Mm-hmm. I normally stayed out here until about 9 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. I worked until 9, then went home. And there were quite a few. Because the library was, you know, it was always quiet, and the books were all there.
But did the hard work pay off academically? Did you do quite well, or was it
some courses didn't do so well. Oh, I never had a failure.
Yeah.
I had some that were near misses.
Yeah,
but no, it's sort of second class. I ended up with a second class average, mm-hmm. and some courses are still a mystery to me. Wills and trusts, although I ended up doing wills, you know, writing wills when I was a student. But again, a lot of that stuff is just copy work. You know, 90% of it is copy. It's the same in everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I had a discussion one day with a judge, and said it must really be difficult to come up with a 100-page judgment,
mm-hmm.
you know, in what appears to be a simple matter.
Mm-hmm.
But he said 90% of that stuff is all there's a word.
Boilerplate.
Boilerplate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he said it's that little part that decides the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you find criticism. I see criticism once in a while. That decision was too short.
Hmm.
Well, the decision is, it decided the issue before the court, and that's what the court is there for, not to go into a long expanse. But again, they're looking for appeals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the more you talk about a matter, the more chance there's going to be of making an error,
mm-hmm.
or making something that you can take to a court of appeal and say, look,
mm-hmm.
there should be a different decision made in this case. But
right.
Again,
and what about the facilities of the law school? This is obviously the third building.
As I told you, we started out in the H huts, which were near the canteen. There was the bus stop, and there was a little coffee shop there,
mm-hmm.
and there were three each. Each year had their own hut, and it was shared with teacher training, or I've forgotten. But it was way on the other side of the campus, and was there some sort of a hut here or something? I've forgotten now. Because that first year I went someplace else to work. And I've forgotten where that other place was. I know the first law school was, you know, people were carrying books and stuff into the new building. Maybe it was an H hut of some kind that was converted. I've just forgotten. My memory is very hazy about that period. I remember having carried books, the library, moving it from one place to another. And then the new one, I think it was the second year, and it was like heaven.
Mm.
You know, the law school was, we each had our own room, and it was a place to work, and the library was there, and it was, you know, it was very nice compared to what it was previously.
And the vets, were there must have been vets still in the law school?
Lots. Quite a few vets. And some of them worked in the, you know, the library. Others worked downtown. There were some married vets.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the married people had a place on the other side of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
The single ones, Fort Camp, down here below. That's where the single people lived. And the married vets had Acadia, I think it was
Acadia,
called, Acadia
yeah.
Camp. And some of those people, Les England, went to law school here. He ended up in the legal branch. And he lived in that Acadia camp for a while.
You must remember that I didn't bring a list of the class of 1952, but who were some of the other graduates of that year?
Well, Mary Southern, you know,
we've talked to her.
Yeah, well, I think, again, this is one of these things that one hesitates to speak about, because in those days, someone else got the prize for being number one,
mm-hmm.
a male. And a lot of people felt that Mary really should have got mm-hmm. first prize, because you know, she's a very clever person.
I am sure she would talk about that. I have interviewed her.
Yeah.
And I don't think she mentioned that, but it might not have come up.
I don't think she, no, Mary probably wouldn't mention it, I don't think. And maybe it was just other people said, you know, Mary, you know, Mary should have got it. Mm-hmm. And she got first. Well, there were three first classes in our, Don mm-hmm. Tuck, mm-hmm. Mary, and Gil. Gil got the first prize.
Don Tuck.
He's still practicing, or maybe he's just recently retired. Don Tuck. He was with what's his name, big firm downtown. I just forgot the name of the firm, but he was in that class, and he was also a first. He got a first, three firsts.
I've been impressed in my interviews with the with how smart some of the people are, because I went into history into graduate school, and I guess all the professions, the people compete to get into them, and there's been incredibly capable people. We've talked to everyone from to Mike Harcourt, and we want to talk to Kim Campbell. So obviously there's a great deal of talent. But were there, you said there were three firsts. Was that the entire, were there only three and everyone else was in the second category?
And pass, yeah. Three categories. Mm-hmm. First three, they're marked in that in the book.
Oh.
The grades are beside the names in the book that I'm going to leave with you.
Great, okay. Well,
so you can look at that and you'll see the three ones, and the rest, there are a bunch of twos, and then there are a bunch of, mostly P's, which you pass.
Mm-hmm. I'll make sure the books go to the archives, to the university archives, so that future researchers can look at that.
I'm sure those things must exist, because every student got one of these things.
They probably have them, but it'll be, but we're getting a small collection of documents from the people we interview, so we'll give them a separate collection.
Yeah.
So those will be very handy. So the vets must have been quite a lot older, some of them, if they had spent the entire time in the war.
They were in their 20s. Most of them are in their late 20s. I don't think there were many in older than that. Well, we had one elderly chap, Air Commodore Hull. He had retired as an Air Commodore and came to law school. And he was in our class. He was the oldest one. He must have been 65 or older.
What happened to him? Did he
practice? He went into practice.
Yeah.
He went into practice, I think maybe on the island somewhere. And I'm not really familiar with the facts, but I'd heard that he had run into some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Just that he had forgotten some law that he should have remembered or something of that nature. A stumble, in other words. Mm-hmm. Not anything that, illegal or anything like that. It was just a stumble in maybe some of the advice he had given or something of that nature. Anyway, he was the oldest, and
so if he was 65, he must have been born in 1885 or something. That's quite a...
And to get to be an Air Commodore, it was a senior rank in the Air Force, and he was a commander right here in Vancouver. And, he must have been in his 60s.
That you mentioned earlier that you're articling, and then you went to Burnaby to article with them. So what happened after that?
Well, when I was called, when you finished articles, you get your interview with the benchers, and if they approve the interview, or feel that you're qualified to be admitted to the society, you're admitted, and you're sent a couple of certificates, barrister and solicitor certificates, and that's it. Mm. You can go out and hang up your shingle, or you could, you know, do whatever you want to do. Mm. And in my case, when I was told I was in, I had to inform the military, and of course that's when I was promptly sent off to Calgary. Sorry, I take that back, because I went to Calgary before that. I was in Vancouver here. I worked in the transit depot, the number 11 personnel depot. And then when I was called to the bar, they notified Ottawa that this chap, this Lieutenant Karwandi, has now been called to the bar. What do you want to do with him? Hmm. So we'll send him to the JAG for 6 months appraisal.
They can't have had many qualified lawyers in the armed forces, at the young lawyers.
They had, I don't know, maybe 30. Yeah. 30 or 40 of all ages. Tony Kobus was the man I mentioned to you that graduated here for first year. And in Art MacDonald's book, he pretty well indicates that I was in there for about, 2 years in Ottawa, 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And the vacancy came up in New Brunswick. They wanted a lawyer down there. The base commander said he needs a lawyer. The base is big. There are an awful lot of troops here. There are legal problems. He wants a lawyer. And I had my 2 years, and of course I was ready to go anywhere. They just, do you want to go? Okay, I'll go. And they sent me off to New Brunswick. And I was actually stationed in Fredericton. Fredericton was my office, and Gagetown was 15 miles down the road. So I'd spent a lot of time in Gagetown. At the same time, I was given territorial jurisdiction because there were bases in other parts of New Brunswick and in Prince Edward Island. And I was given the responsibility of looking after the legal problems of all the base military units in Nova Scotia, in New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island. And once in a while, I had to go to Newfoundland as well. So that was that for, 3.5 years, 4 years, of lots of driving around and lots of problems.
What kind of, I don't know if you're allowed to talk about the problems, but what kinds of, I can imagine a court martial and that kind of thing, but what were typical problems that military people get themselves into?
Well, on the legal aid side, we did an awful lot of legal aid because families had problems the same that families have everywhere, but they were in a military base, and they were reluctant to go to lawyers, and in fact sometimes there weren't any lawyers available. Mm-hmm. And so you would have to deal with those cases, and they would be marital problems and children's problems and that sort of stuff. And then the ones that were in married quarters were fine, but the ones that were living with in rental accommodation, they would have squabbles with landlords and that sort of thing. So those were the sorts of problems that you would be faced with. Business problems I don't really want to discuss because a lot of those things were classified. Mm-hmm. And they may be, maybe unclassified now, but I'm not, not aware. At the time I gave advice in respect of those problems, they were highly classified, so I can't mention those.
Was the legal training you had here at UBC, was it a good foundation?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Mind you, on top of that, the military law, we have the National Defense Act, as you're probably aware, and it's a totally different law. We have our own criminal code, and there are vast administrative orders that have legal implications. And those were the problems that we would have to deal with, and aside from courts martial. And then, of course, minor discipline problems, drafting charges, because commanding officers who were faced with dealing with these problems very often would not be able to draft a charge that was appropriate, even if it was a simple absence without leave offense. He would call the lawyer and say, I got this guy that's been on the loose for 2 weeks or whatever. Can you help me with a charge? Mm-hmm. So you'd go down and you'd draft the charge. Mm-hmm. And that sort of matter.
You must have seen all kinds of human nature issues.
Different in Canada than in Europe. In Canada, a lot of those issues are dealt with by the civil authority, RCMP or a civil authority. In Europe, of course, there you dealt with all those issues because they're totally different scenario in Europe than in Canada. Mm. Because in Europe, where I also served, there was no Canadian authority. You were the authority. Mm. You were the sort of attorney general for the Canadian forces.
And here comes Graham. We'll keep going for a while. There's Graham, Frank.
How do you do?
Well, Graham, we've been ranging from Saskatchewan up to UBC and into Articling and into the
New Brunswick.
and so this is the outfit was called the
Judge Advocate General
JAG.
And
you got into that because you were in the armed forces anyway. Did you have a choice? Could you have left and gone into civic, into regular legal practice, or did you enjoy the military work?
I enjoyed the military work. I had no yen to go to City Street and work in a law office. Because I had friends who had gone through the experience and they had gone into the military because they said the law office was just too boring. Mm-hmm. And you're stuck in the same place. With the military, you're moving around a lot and it's a totally different way of life.
And you ended up as the Judge Advocate General.
Yes.
For Canada in 1982 to 86, but what were the steps along the way? Were you?
Well, from New Brunswick, I did my 3.5 years there, and then I was sent to Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And I was in Edmonton for almost 5 years. And looking, again, doing a lot of travel, courts martial, that usual work that any legal officer is required to do. And from there, I was sent to Germany, posted to Germany, and were in Germany for 3 years. And there, of course, it was a totally different life because we were responsible for all legal matters. I should say, we had to get permission from the German authority in the case of murder, rape, and manslaughter. If one of our soldiers committed one of those offenses, we would have to go to the German authority and seek permission for jurisdiction, because they had the basic right of jurisdiction in those three cases.
But everything else was...
Everything else was our problem. And I should say that the Germans invariably gave us permission. And we had a few murder cases and other serious cases that we had to refer to them. But primarily the largest number of cases involved alcohol, because Canadians just were not used to the way that the Europeans deal with alcohol. And that was a problem. Alcohol featured in a lot of cases.
So you mean that because the Europeans are more accustomed to it?
Yes, or? Yeah.
So these new Canadians would arrive there and there'd be beer fests or that kind of thing?
And cheap. You know, and And you see German drivers, you know, drinking a bottle of beer or something, and that was accepted. But 5 or 6 bottles of beer was not. Mm. You know, that's a Canadian. He couldn't stop at one bottle, he'd have to have more. And of course, that would lead to trouble.
And you said you were a kind of the Attorney General for the Canadian Forces. Is that the term you used?
You mean in Germany?
Yeah.
Oh, no, in Germany we had to solve all the legal problems in-house. And as said, from the towards the very end, the Germans started refusing to give us permission in murder cases. But the early times we did murder cases, we did everything. And we had two types of trial. We had general courts to do the major serious offenses, and then disciplinary courts, which dealt with the drunk driving, the road, you know, the minor offenses. And the largest percentage of cases would be handled by a disciplinary court martial. And again, the normal military type of offenses, the absence without leave and stuff, the commanding officer would have jurisdiction over those cases and deal with them himself, unless he wanted you to draft the charges or something like that. But when in the case of the two courts martial, we'd always have to provide legal officers, defending counsel, prosecutor, and normally the judge advocate, who would advise the panel, because the panel was military people, military officers, who required legal advice, and the JA was there to provide the legal advice to them.
So did you have quite a big staff to help you?
No. We had, in our office, we had 3 lawyers, 4 lawyers, and a couple of court reporters. That's it. We had other duties in Germany too that involved civilian matters, but that was a separate department. But from the disciplinary point of view, and of course we had to move around. You know, if for instance, in certain unit, if a court-martial offense occurred in a certain unit, that was my responsibility, I would have to prosecute that case. And then the defense would normally come from an Air Force unit, you know, a couple of 100 miles away. And the accused would have a choice. He could decide which, but it would always be a legal officer from one or the other of the bases.
Did you have a lot of contact with the British and American advocate generals?
Not really, no. The Americans would always invite us to their big parties and things, but the British, I only remember one time that they gave us, they invited us up. And no, we didn't have that much to do with them, with the other forces.
And so was that for a few years, did you say?
3 years.
3 years.
3 years in Germany.
And what was your position there? Were you in charge of the...
I was, I guess, second. I was second in command as a deputy judge advocate, I guess they're called. I've just forgotten now. The office was run by a wing commander. There was one grade above me.
Graham, feel free to jump in if you have a...
Oh, I'm not sure at this point. I'm still getting the lay of the land.
Oh, you are? Okay, sure. No. And so did you then, you were transferred back to Canada after
back
that?
To Canada, Halifax. So I guess at Halifax for a year and a half, 2 years. And then there was such a critical shortage, I think as he mentioned in the book, in the claim section in Ottawa, that somebody got the bright idea to send me to Ottawa to the claim section, which was 3 years of absolute hell.
Mm. What is a claim section?
Well, it looks after all the claims against the Department of National Defense. Mm. Claims in excess of certain amounts of money, because all of the smaller claims are handled by the bases themselves. But the other types of claims, the more serious claims, end up in Ottawa, in our office. And some of them exceed our jurisdiction. We had to pass them on to the Department of Justice. So we had to prepare the case, send the package to Justice. And it was, there used to be three or four people in that claim section, three or four officers, and we're so short that I was the only person there. And I had one captain who got into trouble. He just lost it. And so we couldn't use him. And I was never so happy to get out of a section all my life. I never worked so hard since law school. In any sort of endeavor, and it was frustrating. So finally, I said, "Okay, you've had enough of this place. You're going to have a nervous breakdown. We'll send you off to Winnipeg."
And were you when you were in these postings? Was it did you deal with the Canadian forces generally, or was it just the Army?
The Canadian Forces.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're the legal branch for all three services. And the other branches, the other services do not have their own legal people. They have, in a sort of an administrative way, they normally have an administrative position that's filled by a lawyer, but it's not called a legal position, it's called an administrative position. So he's sort of an administrative lawyer. But the legal work is all done by the Judge Advocate General's office for all services.
So you were seeing a lot of the armed forces, or familiar with the different branches of the armed forces?
Oh, yes, yes. So and, of course, a lot of lawyers served in other branches. Like my own, I served in armored branch. And a lot of others had served in the Air Force as pilots or, they came with service backgrounds, but there were the odd one that would come in straight off working in a law office or something like that. But, they were service-oriented.
I could imagine that Halifax must have had a large naval component. What about Winnipeg?
Winnipeg was Air Force and Army, basically. But again, it it was mixed work, general, sort of general practitioner's work, legal aid, and odd discipline case that you'd get, there'd be the odd court martial. And of course, you were always subject to go off someplace like Cyprus or somewhere. There'd be some serious courts take place in Cyprus, and you'd have to go off to Cyprus.
That was peacekeeping.
And, the Canadian forces were there, as the peacekeepers. But at the same time, the soldiers got involved in some serious trouble. And we'd have to have a court, court-martial, generally a serious matter, and go off to Cyprus. I've had a few trips to Cyprus. And you can, when you get to Cyprus, you can realize how easy it was to get into trouble. You know, it's one of those places that trouble is easy to get into. But otherwise, the work generally is a mixed bag. You know, just about, you didn't know what, you know, any kind of problem, whatever commander or some military people felt you needed advice about, they might call the lawyer. And you might say, sorry, I can't give you any advice. You'll have to see a practitioner, a private practitioner, because we're not allowed to do that sort of thing. And he'd want, you know, maybe man, you wanted his will draft or something. We could do that overseas, but you couldn't do that here, because there'd be conflict with civilian practitioners.
So it really called into, it sounds like the job required this full complement of what you learned at law school.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mind you, a lot of these legal problems are pretty minor, involving a squabble with a landlord or, you know, the various ins and outs of just everyday living sometimes have a problem that somebody wants to talk to a lawyer about. And
were there any services in the military at that time for counseling or therapy, or was that sort of what you did?
The Air Force had a welfare. They called them welfare officers, and they were actually trained to do that sort of thing. But half the time, the welfare officer would be in your office, asking you questions.
Yeah.
You know, because they would get legal type of question, because sometimes it's difficult, because welfare problem might have a legal aspect, and probably very often does. But the Air Force had that. The Army and the Navy didn't. The lawyers had to do that sort of welfare work. And
it sounds like you saw all kinds of aspects of human nature.
Bad stuff. A lot of bad sides of human nature.
Oh, dear. Because the good stuff doesn't end up
in the lawyer's office. No.
But you're not allowed, and you can't write novels about it, because it's all, I suppose it's confidential.
In Ottawa, particularly, the last job I had in Ottawa, because from Winnipeg I went to Ottawa, and I was in the advisory section there, and half the time I spent my time in the deputy minister's office. And, the matters are serious when the deputy minister wants to talk to a lawyer. And those things you can't talk about. They're all confidential. And you're just in a different circle in Ottawa. It's I don't like Ottawa at all. I never liked Ottawa. It's a difficult place to work. Politics play a very important part of work in Ottawa. And of course, in the military, we have no politics. It's a military career does not involve politics. And
what was the, when you finally became the judge advocate general, what happened then? What was the process? Were you appointed by the?
By the Governor General and Council. Yeah, got a big one.
Gee.
Big thing.
Oh.
Yeah. And
QC
came in after that. It sort of followed on the appointment. And that's a federal QC, not a BC QC. So, and that was a sort of a pressure cooker.
Mm.
4 years. It's, you're the top man. There's no one else you can talk to, and you're it. And you're going to be dealing with a lot of people that have very serious problems.
By that time, you must have seen a good deal of the kinds of problems.
Yeah. Yeah. And very often, because it's leading up, and the boss, the guy that's the JAG, sometimes has to come to you if you're the DJAG in advisory.
The deputy.
Yeah. And he comes to you and he discusses a matter with you. And that works fine. But very often he can't do that. You know, it's the chief calls him over, the chief of the defense staff calls him over and has a question that he's got to deal with.
And what about the other branches of government in Ottawa, the legal branches, the justice?
Justice, of course, there's always a rivalry between the JAG and the justice. And while I was there, we had two justice people in our office in Ottawa. But they didn't deal with military matters. They dealt with essentially civilian matters that the Department of Justice had to deal with. And so we got along well with them, but I think there was always a rivalry between the Department of Justice and the military legal people.
Could you go to them for advice or help?
Some of our officers went to them after they retired from the military,
because
you could stay in justice until you were 65 or something. Military, you had to get out at 52 or maybe 50. So they ended up in justice. I personally never had too much to do with justice. I knew some of the people there. But justice always felt that they were the top dogs in the legal business and the government, and everybody else were, you know, lesser.
Were they they were political appointments too, I suppose, the Minister of Justice, or how does he?
No.
How does he?
No. I think they were civil servants.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, you applied for a job with the government, and if you were a lawyer, you would get sent to justice. No, they were civil servants.
Mm.
Yeah. Even the deputy minister is a civil servant. All the time I served with the Judge Advocate General's office, I felt that there was a bit of a competition with justice. And if anything, we always felt that they were jealous of the work that we did, because they wanted to do that work. But it never happened.
What were, and now this was 82 to 86, so it's quite a long stint. You're probably not allowed to talk about what the main issues or the.
Well, the first 5 years in Ottawa, my last 5 years there, was I was the advisory.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have about three departments working for me. Yeah, they would send their files up to me, and I have to sign them, that sort of thing. But again, most of those problems were really difficult to put your finger on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were such a mixed bag,
right.
And a lot of them required a particular answer that required more than just a legal knowledge. You had to temper the answer somehow with law, but at the same time make it appear that it wasn't just a legal answer. And I know it's a difficult concept to try to get across, but that's what a lot of the work was. It was that sort of stuff. And most of the time, you're just the boss there, that they would come and talk to you. Your staff would come and say, what do you think about such and such a problem? And you would have to sit down and have a chat. Not that, you know, you were any wiser than he was, but at least to get two heads better than one. But it was a lot of letter signing and that sort of thing. You know, a person in charge of several sections, you always got that sort of work to do. But the trouble with Ottawa, with the work we had, a lot of it is so confidential. Mm-hmm. It had, you know, seals, you know. That's the problem with dealing with government matters. There, a lot of them are sensitive. Mm-hmm. And you just can't talk about them. That's the long and the short of it. And
so was Ottawa the end of your career?
Yes.
Did you ended there, so
yeah.
You must, if you were born in 27, you must have retired in early 90s?
I retired in, when did it was, I was 60, 50, what? My memory is slipping.
Well, 86 you were the...
86 I retired.
80, okay.
So I was actually, I'd retired a year, practically a year before that, but I had leave coming, so they tacked on the leave before they finally booted me out. So I've been doing nothing since.
did
except
you move
condo.
Except what?
Except working in the condo. For draft the bylaws for the condo.
Oh, and this is in...
in South Surrey.
Where
I live now. So, but that's about the only legal work I've had to do, is draft those condo, those regulations for the house, for the houses.
And did you keep, when you were in the military, did you keep in contact with other people from your class at UBC?
With, not really. Of course, the UBC people were there in our branch. You'd meet with them all the time. But no, not with anybody else. I had never had any reason, as a matter of fact.
And is there, now that you're back here, have you found there's an active class of 52 reunion?
There was. I'll have to put it that way, because it's sort of tailed off. And I think the last one was in a private house. Mm-hmm. And since then, I haven't heard. It just seems to have died. To begin with, when Dean Curtis was alive, we used to have a fairly large gathering in down the courthouse. They'd get the one of the upstairs places, and there'd be 30 or 40 people there. There were certain people that don't go. That Mary Southern was one. She would not attend because she thought it was a conflict with being a judge to associate with lesser beings. I shouldn't put it that way with lawyers. But Pat Fallman would always go, and she was a judge.
That's Pat Proudfoot.
What's her married name?
Fallman.
She's got a married name.
Proudfoot, I think.
Proudfoot.
We interviewed her.
Right. And she would always come. But that was the only race we had. And again, it was a question of getting together with the people that you were friendly with or associated with at law school. Hmm. You sort of club. You know, we had a few dinners and that sort of thing. And you'd be sitting next to the people that you had been familiar with at law school. And there were, you knew who everybody was, of course, but you didn't have any reason to speak to them. And of course, the dean would always be around, Dean Curtis, and Charles Barn. He'd always talk to everybody. And but those things are just completely petered out. And it may be because there are a lot of people have passed on, or there's no interest.
Well, we are finding it difficult to find graduates from the 1940s, from those early classes. But the 50s happened too, I guess.
51s should be okay. Yeah. And 50 should be okay, because I still see pictures of groups of 8 to 10 people and from previous classes. I haven't seen one 52 for a long time, so I don't know what's gone haywire in the class of 52. But and then, you know, I'm so far in South Surrey, it's like being in another world. If you're in Vancouver, it's a different matter. But I just haven't heard.
I was meaning to look at the list of 52 graduates before the interview, and I forgot. But I could look later and see who else we talked to. I know Pat Fallon, Proudfoot, and Mary Southern, and I think one or two more. I think we're Jane Bamfield.
Yeah.
I think we've talked to her, and Joan Cape Brown Cave, who was Joan Peacock, talked to her.
We only had about 5 women in our class.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were 5. And one of them married what's his name? Ballum.
Ballum.
Student married Professor Bell. Yeah, I when I went to law school, I never got to one of the they had an annual ball. Mm-hmm. Some of those balls were a little hectic.
Yeah.
And some of them almost came to fisticuffs. And someone told me one time that Professor Bell was very handy with his fists. I guess there must have been some sort of an altercation. With alcohol, of course, there's, you know, there's bound to be.
Yeah. I was going to ask earlier, it's a funny question, but Karwandi is an unusual name. What's the origin?
Oh, Austrian.
Is it? What was that? So?
I think what happened was there was a lot of shifting there. Austria got all busted up after the First World War. And I think it's probably part of that got shifted to Hungary or somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's where that funny name came from. But there were a lot of divisions. Austria used to be a big country until the First World War hacked it up. Mm-hmm. They picked the wrong side to be on.
Yeah, yes.
And but I think that's the only explanation I have.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Pat Fallon, I think, is also from a German.
Pat Fallon.
Yes, in Saskatchewan, I think.
Yeah, someplace near Regina.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and her family moved out, I think, to Kelowna, where Graham's from. Well, I should just look through and see if I had any other jotted down other questions. I was going to ask about your family and your siblings. You're the oldest of 5.
Yeah.
Are they all back on the prairies still?
Yes. Those that are alive, there are only two brothers and a sister. That's all that's left. And they come out here whenever. They like it out here too, but it's expensive living out here, and I feel that they can live more cheaply in Saskatchewan.
Yeah. That's right. And,
I have a wife.
Oh, you do?
Yes, and no family.
Where's your wife from?
Winnipeg.
And did you meet her when you were there, or?
Where did I meet her? I think it was out here. She was a nurse. She's a nurse. She was a nurse, and she worked. I've forgotten where she worked. She ended up at St. Paul's, I know, working in the hospital there.
What's her name?
Esther.
Esther.
Yeah, she went to Alberta, University of Alberta. She got a Bachelor of Applied Science, Nursing Science. She got that while we were stationed in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. She decided to go to university and picked up the degree there. So she's not in good health right now, so.
Oh, dear. Well, thanks very much. I don't know if there's anything you want to add or that you forgot, or Graham, you might hear.
I've forgotten most of what happened, as I think you appreciate.
Well, it sounds like you're the only person we've talked to with a military career, so it's very different actually from the usual downtown law firm.
Well, you know, a lot of the older lawyers here served in the legal branch during the last war.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, quite a few of them. And some of them, you know, some of the lawyers actually weren't in the military, in the legal branch. They were ordinary commanders, you know, and led divisions and, you know, large groups of military people. So Vancouver's got quite a, you know, a military connection. Mm-hmm. Again, time, you know, time is killing us off. And I'm 85.
I know that the dean mentioned that she'd like to, if she's around, she would like to, she was going to pop in and say hi, but maybe on the way down we could see if she's, take you down and meet her.
Oh, that'd be nice.
But thank you very much.
I hope I wasn't too dull.
It was extremely interesting. Thanks very much.
Because I'm not the best speech maker.
No, it was